Hello, my name's Tamsin Westhorpe and welcome to Fresh from the Pod Gardening Stories. What is it that us gardeners just can't resist talking about every single day of the year? Well, of course, it's the weather. Now, in this episode, I have a fascinating talk with meteorologist and ITV's Good Morning Britain weather presenter, Laura Tobin. We talk about the changing weather, how it affects us as gardeners, and I'm also fascinated to ask Laura about why she was so keen to become a meteorologist. Good morning, Laura. It's so exciting to have you on Fresh from the Pod because, as you know, I'm a keen gardener and weather is 99% of my conversation. It's a key part of gardening. So last night we had a really, I would say, a bad storm. How does that impact on your day?
So for me, the more severe the weather, the more time I'm going to get to web broadcasting on air and the more prep that I need to do. And actually, for me, everything in the world of weather is really interesting. But it's really important for me to listen to people around me, my friends, what people are talking about, what I see on social media feeds, what my mum is saying. Because, you know, even I was walking yesterday and I heard some ladies go, the day before and said, oh, it's good we're out for a walk today. It's lovely and sunny because it's going to be turning wet through the next few days. Oh, and windy. And I just think, I love that. I love that people are really listening and that's, you know, I have to take what is a really, really complicated science and make it really simple, really easy to understand and be as digestible as that. You know, yesterday I was just saying, all change with the weather. It's turning wet and windy. And if you needed to know one thing, that is it. But on top of that, obviously, it's giving extra detail. Like today, trees were down, power lines were down, people without power, lorries were overturned, roads were closed, there are power outages. So I have to relate all that as well, but still in a really short space of time.
Yeah, so what's your daily routine? So you're on Good Morning Britain for ITV. So mm-hmm. You've got to get up at the crack of dawn, I take it.
Yeah, so I'm up at 4 a.m.
Oh, gosh.
And it's a little different in a pandemic world. I, among with many of the presenters, I'm driving myself, which makes it quite challenging, not because of my driving, my driving's not great, actually, because I would normally do all my research in the car. So I would normally phone the Met Office. We would talk about the weather for the day and I would normally check all of my social media feeds, put in keywords and see what weather events are happening around the world. So I have to do that all when I get to work now. And then normally I would have my hair and makeup done, but being the pandemic, I'm doing my own hair and makeup as well.
I saw you cutting your own hair, actually. That was brilliant. You were cutting your own hair on Instagram.
Our head of wardrobe, Debbie, said, your hair is getting quite... He's struggling, really, he's cutting. And I said, Debbie, we're in a pandemic. The hairdressers aren't open. And she just went, well, I'm just pointing it out. So that night, our work hairdressers were getting very worried and saying, oh, my goodness, I hope she's okay. But yeah, I did an okay job. I think if you're a scientist, which I am, you can approach everything with a sort of like a science mindset. And I just, you know, had a strategy and it all went okay. So I did that. So yeah, once I've done my hair and my makeup, when I get to work, I just check on my work emails, speak to the producer about stuff from the night before. So that comes later in the day. And I go into the studio at about 5:45. We're on air from 6:00 and do some pre-records and just make sure that everything is ready, run through any content that I have. So today I was talking about severe weather in Hawaii. I always like to look at different weather events or climate stories or space stories or interesting, you know, the volcanic activity, anything to do with nature or the environment. I like to add that into my weather reports because I think it's nice to just have that extra little bit of science. And lots of people have said that they really enjoy that. So that's great. And then the weather's on every half an hour. And we're finished by 9:00 and then we have a debrief. We'll chat about the next day's show. Before the pandemic, I'd normally go to different teams and talk about projects we had coming up. So it's like science week, but we would normally be on outside broadcasts. We might be going to schools. We might be doing some fun experiments, but that's obviously not happening at the moment. But normally I'd be preparing to go on outside broadcasts and planning. So we'll be hopefully doing more of that when we start to see the easing in lockdown. And then in the afternoon, I'll start checking my weather feeds again, seeing if there's any interesting stories, and then pass them on to the news team and speak to the Met Office about what extra graphics I want. So there's sort of like a morning shift and like an afternoon shift. So yesterday afternoon, I was asking for video footage from Hawaii. I was researching Hawaii and sending that brief in to work, asking the Met Office for extra charts, looking at the wind gusts, extra charts, looking at the warnings, and then making sure that I put on my social media feeds, particularly Twitter, that there are warnings for wind and that there's going to be severe weather so that people are prepared for overnight into the next day. So, I mean, my main body of work is in the morning, but I have like a little shift in the afternoon too.
Now, do you think people realise that you are a trained, qualified meteorologist? Do you think people think, well, she's just reading a script? Do you ever have that to battle with?
For years, yes. And I mean, people are always shocked that weather presenters don't read auto cue. No weather forecaster that I know in this country, around the world, that I've ever met does. I think for a couple of reasons. One, I just said funnily enough. One, weather is a really natural, fluidly delivered presentation that isn't as scripted as news, and it's very communicative and it's meant to be quite familiar and friendly with the audience. So if you were scripted, it would sound really red and I don't think it would resonate. It wouldn't work as well. Also, particularly for me, my durations can change. I could have 30 seconds that I had for one of my weathers today all the way up to 2 minutes. So you'd have to write handfuls of scripts for different durations. And I started as a junior forecaster in the Met Office at an RAF base, and I was the first young person and the first girl. So I was really aware that I was a very different looking person coming into forecasting for pilots flying all over the world, and that they may have different opinions of how I may look. But the most important thing to me was that I was able to do my job as good as anybody else. And after working exceptionally hard, everyone just forgets whether you're a girl or whether you're young, and you're just one of the team. So, you know, I think I have for a long time, because I might look a certain way because I'm a girl and I like dressing up and I like hair and makeup and I like to put on some heels. The perception may be that you don't know what you're talking about, but hopefully it comes across that I do, because as you say, yes, I did physics and meteorology, and, you know, there are weather presenters who aren't necessarily qualified meteorologists, in inverted commas, as such. They haven't necessarily done a degree in meteorology. But the most important thing is that you're passionate about it and that you love it. And you can tell by the delivery that we are, all of our weather teams, just love the weather. And why not? Because we talk about it, like you said, all the time.
But you and I met earlier this year. You came to Stockton Brew My Garden, and we were working on a video. You're working with Honda to come up with weather videos for gardeners, which is really exciting.
Yes.
And I've never met you before then, but your enthusiasm is so obvious. It's almost hilarious. You can't stop talking about the weather, can you?
I know. When we're at work, if someone has an ailment, they'll often go, oh, Dr. Hillary, can I ask you this and can I ask you that? And he's always very polite, and I'm never sure if he's bothered. But sometimes people might say to me, oh, I just have a quick question about the weather. I hope you don't mind. And then someone will say, she doesn't mind. She could talk about it all day. Yeah. And I literally could. I mean, barely the two of us barely got a word in edgeways what anyone else did. The two of us, I think, we're equally passionate about our own subjects. And absolutely loved coming to visit you. And I'll be so happy when you guys can open.
Yeah, it'd be great. You'll have to come do the weather from there. But what was fascinating for me is it really sort of firmed up the fact that weather and gardening, they do go hand in hand. And
completely,
we are having to change the way we're gardening because weather is changing. Mm-hmm. I mean, with climate change, and what's the most dramatic change that you think we're seeing?
Well, in the UK and around the world, climate change is happening. The world is warming. And the phrase that is used is, it's undeniable. It's undeniable that it's human caused. It's human induced because we're pumping out greenhouse gases to levels that haven't been seen for millions of years. And it's not that it's how high they are now or how high the temperature is. It's how quickly both the greenhouse gases and the temperature have been rising. And we used to talk about global warming, which was just physically the temperature going up, but climate change encompasses everything else that comes with it. So it comes with the melting ice caps, it comes with the huge wildfires, it comes with the droughts, it comes with extreme storms, it comes with record temperatures. And when I was a junior forecaster, I was taught to never forecast a record because they've stood for such a long time for a reason. You know, they're really hard to break. And I would say in the last 5 years, if not the last 2 years, the records are just dropping, the hottest day this, the wettest month that, the sunniest this, not just in the UK, but around the world. And I think we almost become flippant with the fact that things, records are breaking because they happen so often. And sometimes we just stop and think, wow, yes. You know, we talk about the summer of 1976. It was a huge prolonged heat wave. And then we had the heat wave back in the UK, was it 2 years ago, when we had the highest temperature the UK's ever recorded, 38.7, on the 25th of July, 2019. I remember because it was my daughter's birthday and we couldn't go anywhere other than sit in the paddling pool. And heat is going to be a big thing. We will have two things in the UK. We will have warmer, wetter winters and we will have hotter, drier summers. And it has impacts on so many things, infrastructure, health, well-being. But in the gardening world, it has huge, huge ramifications because actually our weather and our climate will become more like a Mediterranean climate. The type of plants that we can grow will change, which for some will be a positive. But then the type of plants that are very common to the UK and are our, you know, bread and butter and the thing that makes British gardens British, well, we won't be able to be growing those things anymore. So wetter winters and fewer frosts is a massive challenge for gardens and gardeners who need those frosts and don't want all the torrential rain. And in the summer, you know, we will have massive problems with water shortages because they'll be hotter and drier. So you'll get these big heat waves and yes, you'll still get rain, but it may come in thunderstorms. There'll be torrential on parched ground, which is also an issue. So there is so much to think about in how people manage and their gardens for the future.
Yeah. I mean, what is the hardest thing, I think, and I'm noticing this already, is in the winter, my garden is soaking wet. I mean, literally plants are sitting in water. And in the summer, they're, you know, parched. And, you know, no plant can tolerate that. So it may be that we end up, you know, having borders that we have to change dramatically as the season goes. It's definitely a challenge. Now, we did, when we met, we talked about, I love my lawn, and we were talking about the value of having lawns because of drainage. You know, if we put too many hard surfaces down with the number of rain storms we're expecting, it's a worry, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I've done the weather for many years on outside broadcast, and I've been to RHS flower shows, and there they had, for the last few years, actually, a lovely project or campaign called Green in Grey Britain. So making sure that green spaces stay green and that we don't grey them over. And it is really important to keep as much lawn and as much grass as you can. We have this thing in the weather called the urban heat island effect, which is that towns and cities, because there's more concrete, there's more pavements, there's less green spaces, are naturally hotter than the surrounding rural areas. And in fact, when we have heat waves, they could be up to 5 degrees warmer, which in itself has massive implications for people's health and well-being. But if we add more artificial surfaces rather than having these lovely green surfaces, it will continue to have a, you know, detrimental effect. So yes, green and lawns are really big. And of course, you know, it's really nice to have some areas of your lawn that you don't cut, that you have lovely, you know, increase the biodiversity in your garden, whether you have little bug hotels, we've got one of those, just everything that you can do just to help a little. But I mean, lawns, I think, will be one of the first things impacted by climate change in gardens. One, because we look at them to look at the impact of climate change. So grass is one of the first things that starts growing, one of the last things that stops growing, because you obviously need warm weather for grass to grow. And we've seen that growing seasons are getting longer and some cutting their lawns all year round. So grass is one of the things that we look at and is a really big indicator about climate change, because it's one of the first things that starts growing and it's one of the last things that finishes growing. So from that, we can look at how long our growing season is. And it really helps us to monitor the impacts of climate change in our gardens. And it's something that the Met Office have been working with the RHS to look at really in depth. So you'll be cutting your lawns for longer. Some already cutting their lawns all year round, which is remarkable. And that is happening mostly in the south of the UK. And that will progressively happen further north. So great news for some, bad news for others. But with it being warmer, the grass will also grow for longer as well. And it'll be much, much quicker. So you'll be having to cut much more often. So being prepared for that. And as you said, as long as you're prepared at the end of the season, you'll be good to go for the start of the next season. But then throughout the year, you know, you've got to deal with the really hot, dry, parched land that you're going to have, and how you irrigate your grass and how you keep it watered, because that's obviously one of the key things to maintaining grass. But in the winter, how you deal with those waterlogged gardens. So, I mean, you gave loads and loads of top tips, because we are yet to do our first cut, but loads of top tips about how we can deal with all of those things.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think we probably have to hold off watering our lawns and accept the fact that they will get parched and they will bounce back. I mean, lawns, fortunately, are incredibly robust, which is, oh, thankfully. Now, the other thing that all us gardeners watch you for is frost alerts. You know, when are we going to get these frosts? On average, in the UK, when is it safe to put your dahlias out, is what people want to know. When is the last frost? Would you say it's so varied, it's impossible to say what's...
Yeah, I mean, it really is varied. I used to be an open road forecaster. So I used to be a gritting forecaster at Cardiff Weather Centre. And we used to work with councils when they used to go out to need to grit their roads. So that obviously would be when there was a frost and temperatures were sub-zero. And we used to start our gritting season in October, and it ran for October, November, December, January, February, and ended in March. And the longer I worked there, we had very, very few October nights of frost, and actually very few in November. So the open road season didn't start until the middle of November. Already signs from, you know, the decades that people have been working on it that season is shrinking. But we did find that we had a couple of times that we actually needed to be called in at the end of March or even into April. So it's almost like there's a bit of a shift. The frosts are much fewer into the end of autumn, but to the beginning of winter. But that cold is still left over from winter when we start to spring. So all it takes, like we had a few years ago and actually more recently, the beast from the east, it just needs to take one flip in the wind for that to be a prolonged easterly to bring the sub-zero temperatures. But I would say, you know, March is, I think April you would be pretty safe to have very, very few frosts. March, there are still frosts around and you are still really on that knife edge. But again, in a world of warming weather and in a world where we have climate change, you know, in the UK, I think a report from the Met Office said that on average, I think we have around about 39 days of frost, say in London, for example, per year. And by the end of, I can't remember whether it was 2070 or by the end of the century, but by then we may only have 9 frost days a year. So maybe by then March will be safe. But for now, I think keep them in for March.
So really, we're looking at longer summers, sort of almost blurring into autumn, and then later springs. Gosh, more challenges ahead. Crikey. So frost is obviously a big issue. The other issue I have, I absolutely am terrified of high winds. And I think you quite like them, don't you? You like a storm, I'm sure.
I do love a storm. I'm trying to encourage my daughter to love thunderstorms and heavy rain and winds. She's not too keen, but she is only 3. But I just love the power of the wind. When I do broadcast, it's difficult because when there's severe weather, I really need to be in the studio to be able to deliver the message clearly and concisely and research what's going on. For example, looking at, you know, power cuts, road closures, trees down. But it's also really exhilarating being in the wind and being blown by the wind. And I remember me and my team were in Blackpool one year. There was a big storm and the sea was out, but the wind was whipping up the sand and it was hitting us in our faces. Oh, it was so painful. And we hid behind the RNLI building and then we came back out to do the weather and then hid back again. And I mean, when we all got changed, we all had sand everywhere in all of our clothes somehow. And the next day when I went to work, the makeup team said that my face was really smooth because it had been sandblasted the day before in the winds. So, yeah, for me, I just think the wind is exhilarating. And my grandma, she used to be a dinner lady, and she said that the children were always naughtier when it was windy, running around, going crazy. Maybe that's what I do too.
Yeah. So when you were a child, I mean, what was the point when you thought, I want to be in weather? I want to make this my world?
It was a day. It was a one day, a one moment thing, which is astonishing, really. I was 14 and my geography teacher, Mr. Hannant, did a topic about the jet stream. So I've always liked maths. I've always been that kind of girl that's more mathsy, sciencey. And I really loved art, always loved being creative and things. And he taught us about the jet stream, and he got the girls to line up as cold air and the boys to line up as warm air. And he told us to run across the classroom, bumping into each other, and see where we ended up. And we all ended up in this like really wiggly line. And he just said, that is the jet stream. It's warm air and cold air bumping into each other, battling with each other. And the UK sits right under the jet stream. That's why our weather is so varied. So if it wasn't for the fact that we lived here, I wouldn't be probably as interested as I am. And instantly, I just thought, that's cool. That just resonated with me immediately. It was really, really visual. And I phoned the Met Office at 14 to say, what have I got to do to become a weather forecaster?
That's brilliant.
So I had to do A-level maths and physics. The maths I was fine with. The physics, I was a bit like, oh no, physics. You know, 14, telling a 14-year-old girl she's going to do A-level physics is not the dream scenario. And I really struggled, actually. My first year, I really struggled. We had one exam. I got N, which is apparently nearly. I had to resit and actually end up getting an A after loads of hard work. The physics didn't click initially. And then I loved it so much that I did a split degree that was physics and meteorology. And just really lucky enough that during my final year, I was doing a research project and saw the job advert for a Met Office forecaster and applied and went and then got the job. And, you know, it's all just panned out from there. You know, it's difficult because I don't want to tell every 14-year-old, you must know what you want to do. Or some people who may be my age, 39, still don't even know what they want to do. Don't feel like they've had their calling. But, you know, I've just always done something I've been passionate with, and I've always tried to take risks. And, you know, I didn't ever want to be on the TV. That wasn't my aim. I just love weather. I wanted to just look at it and be in it. And I forecast, like I said, the Gritting forecasts and the Hill Walking forecast and local radio. Then I worked at the RAF forecasting for pilots that flew all over the world, because that job came up and someone told me it was really good. And then my boss said, oh, the BBC are looking for a short-term cover. And I said, oh, you know, I've always said I didn't want to do that, because as soon as you're a girl who likes weather, people just go, oh, you're going to be a weather girl. So I kind of said I would never do it. And then I looked around the BBC Weather Centre and I saw that it was so much more than just pointing at a green screen. It was doing online forecasts, helping write the forecast, helping speak to the regional presenters, brief them, different outputs from BBC One to Radio 4, shipping forecast. And I think it's definitely changed the perception of weather forecasters and the weather team and weather broadcasts and how much more they deliver. And I would never have dreamt then, you know, now I'm at ITV and I'm, you know, the lead presenter for the weather on Good Morning Britain. And, you know, the weather's different every day and climate change has become a much bigger topic that we talk about. And
so when you say green screen, when I was a kid, my mother would always say the weather forecaster doesn't know what they're looking. There's nothing there. Is that how it is now?
Yes and no. For me, in my studio, because it's a set, and actually on the BBC Breakfast set as well, and I think most of the ITV weather studios, where the presenter is physically in the studio, then you have a plasma, so like a massive TV that you can see the weather graphics just like everyone at home.
Okay.
But when I was at the BBC Weather Centre, all of their broadcasts that are done from the Weather Centre are all done from green screen studios. And I think a lot of American networks still have a Weather Centre. And if you broadcast from the Weather Centre, it's just a green screen. But I mean, months of practice, months and months and months of training. And the camera height is different for everybody. And in theory, your map behind you is different for everybody. But I could have drawn, if you gave me a pen, the whole of the UK almost perfectly because of practicing pointing everywhere. But would have been very different for someone else's setting. So yeah, practice.
Yes. So Scotland has to be in the right place. It's quite a challenge, isn't it?
Yeah, and Northern Ireland, difficult one as well, because it's almost right behind your shoulder. And you don't want to stand in front of the Isles of Scilly, you know, particularly if you're pregnant. You don't want to offend people by cutting off part of the country.
So gardeners at home, you haven't got a television, which, I mean, most people mm-hmm. do, or a radio. Let's think, you know, back many, many years. Are there any sort of ways in which you can predict the weather from home? I mean, my uncle is brilliant at this. He'll just say, right, it's going to rain in 4 hours. Is it something that you just learn about your area? Or are there any ways that a gardener can say, right, I'm going to get a frost here?
Oh, my goodness. There are so many ways. When I first became a forecaster for the Met Office at the RAF, it was my first posting, we used to, as forecasters, work with people called observers, whose job it is, and there are many, many, many of them around the world, is to go out every hour on the hour and look at the weather, record it, put it into a computer, and it goes into the Met Office supercomputer. And that's how weather forecasts are made. It seems really obvious, but if you don't have the observations for what is happening right now, you can't predict the future. So weather forecasts are made by looking at the atmosphere right now, with thousands and thousands of observations done every hour on the hour everywhere around the world. These observers were like gods and magicians, and I would sit there spending ages drawing my little temperature curves and drawing constructions on tephigrams, the graphs and balloons, the radio sounds that go up, trying to figure out what time the fog would clear, trying to figure out what time the inversion would break and the winds would pick up, trying to figure out what time my maximum temperature would be, trying to figure out what time my cumulus clouds would develop, etc. And they would just sit there and go, like a crew would come in and say, oh, what time's the fog going to clear? I say, oh, I've done a calculation. It's going to clear sometime between 10 and 11. And then you'd hear this observer from the other side say, it's not going to clear today. And I'd go, no, I've got it here on my graph. The science says it's going to clear. And then sure enough, it would not clear. And these guys just knew it. They could walk in and they could sniff it. They could sniff out whether the fog would clear. They could tell you whether the cloud was going to lift. And the science, you know, you want it to be right, but it doesn't always work out. You know, weather isn't an exact science. 2 and 2 doesn't always equal 4, because, you know, it's such a local level thing, particularly if you're in a military base and you're trying to forecast visibility within a couple of hundred meters and cloud base within a couple of hundred feet. And it may be half a degree between the cloud clearing and not, and the fog lifting and not. So these guys were just immense, and they were essentially a forecasting resource, because they knew, because they could just smell it. So, you know, there are very experienced gardeners, and there are farmers who have this same skill. They can walk out and look in the morning and they can just tell the fog isn't going to clear. If that's the case, I cannot tell you how to be one of these people. You just have to live and breathe the weather every day, and you will just get it.
Yeah, they've lived in the same place for a long time, a lot of people.
Yeah. And they just get it. And you know, when I came to visit you guys, you have a very, very difficult place to forecast for, because you're in the shadow of the Welsh Hills. So a very subtle change in wind direction for you guys, you know, if it is south-southwesterly, so just south of southwesterly, you will get things feeding up through the Bristol Channel. But if it's more southwesterly or west-southwesterly, it's going to come over the mountains, just most likely to rain out. And then on the other side, there's not enough rain left. You end up with what's called a rain shadow. So you won't have any rain and you'll be dry. And the same can happen. It can be really, really cloudy on one side of the high ground and the other side can be completely clear. Or, you know, we can have rotors. So you have strong winds that hit a mountain, go up and then come down the other side, and it can be particularly windy. So you can either have the best of it or the worst of it. So that's the, you know, that's the nuances that come with weather forecasting, and maybe apps for somewhere like you may struggle more than other places. But I mean, there are some weather folklore, which are often true. So obviously red sky at night, shepherd's delight, red sky in the morning, shepherd's warning. That is often true, because red sky in the morning, shepherd's warning, the sun rises in the south or southeast, and if there was cloud to our east, i.e. there was rain clearing or weather front had passed, you wouldn't get the sunlight coming in. It would hit the cloud and it would stay pretty grey. But if you have a beautiful clear morning, but cloud approaching from the west, then you will get the light refracting and going into that red wavelength, which is why the sky would then be red. And you know, more likely than not, cloud is coming, and cloud would often bring with it rain. And the exact same is true for Red Sky at Night, Shepherd's Delight. The sun sets to the west or southwest. If there was incoming cloud, then you wouldn't be able to see the beautiful sunset. But if it's clear skies to our west and the cloud is the light is bouncing off cloud to our east and then refracts again in that red wavelength, and you have beautiful red skies and beautiful red sunsets, then it's most likely the rain's cleared and that there probably won't be any more wet weather heading your way. So that's a good one.
Gosh. That is a good one. And for listeners,
oh, don't yes, know where sorry.
I live in Herefordshire. So as Laura says, it's on the Welsh border. So yeah, don't move to Herefordshire if you want a good garden. No, we've got great, great soil. We're very lucky.
You often have very nice, sheltered, dry weather. You often do very well.
Yeah, no, it's lovely. Now, the other thing I wanted to ask you is, as a weather genius, where would you live in the country for the best weather? Is that possible to say, right, I always look at that place and think, that's the place to be?
Well, I mean, you say best weather. It depends what kind of weather you like.
True. Yes. I suppose I'm thinking for gardeners.
Well, I guess it depends what kind of garden you want as well. I mean, I have been to Cornwall. It's absolutely beautiful there. And they are a sign of a place that the rest of the UK will slowly follow on to get gardens like. Their climate is that bit drier, that bit warmer, that bit sunnier, and they are growing more sort of tropical plants and slightly more exotic plants. And when people go down to Cornwall, they definitely feel that they're not in the UK. They feel like they are almost abroad and almost on holiday. So that would be somewhere very nice to live. But I mean, I've also been to the complete other end of the country. I did the weather from Shetland because I was doing a week on the road looking at places where TV programs have been filmed. And Shetland was one of the most beautiful places I've ever been to. We had to fly in from mainland Scotland on a little plane. And one of the first things that hits you is there's no trees or very few trees. And they're all very small because it's so windy. And you can barely have any trees. And there's this chill because the waters surrounding them are that much colder than further south where I'm used to living. And I remember that I was there, it was about 16 degrees and it felt quite chilly, even though it was a beautiful sunny day with light winds. And everyone was walking around with T-shirts on and they looked really happy and saying how warm it was. And I think the warmest it's ever been in Shetland is about 21 degrees Celsius. So for them, it was like a balmy summer day. And I think they're closer to Norway than they are to mainland Scotland. I think they're even closer to the Arctic Circle than they are to London. So yeah, I mean, everywhere in the UK is beautiful for different reasons.
Yeah, very good answer, because I think you're right. Because it's, you always want what you haven't got. So I will look at people gardening in Devon and Cornwall and think, oh, I want to grow that, and I can't grow it in Herefordshire. So I think that's what makes gardening so interesting, isn't it?
Definitely.
Like the weather, it's completely varied. Now, the other thing I wanted to ask you about is when you were standing on my lawn, you looked at the sky. I'm surprised you don't fall over, Laura, because you're always looking at the sky. And you said these are street clouds. Am I right? You've got a name for the clouds.
Cloud
Street.
So
what other, that's it. What other fun names can we learn when it comes to clouds?
So all clouds are Latin words and they all have a meaning. So the three basic types of cloud are cumulus, stratus and cirrus. So cumulus is Latin for heap or clump. So they're the little fluffy, fair weather, cotton wool type clouds that we see. Stratus is Latin for layered, and they're the grey straight clouds that have very little definition that you usually see on a miserable overcast day. And cirrus clouds are the cirrus is Latin for a wisp of hair or horse tail, and they're the ones that are at the top of the upper atmosphere. They signify good weather. They look like tiny little streaks and ticks, like a Nike tick in the atmosphere. And pretty much all clouds will tell you about what the weather is doing. So if you see little fluffy clouds, And then maybe an hour or two later, the fluffy clouds have got a bit bigger, a bit wider, a bit taller, a bit greyer, you know that they're growing. And we always used to talk about brightening and whitening. So if you see a cloud, the top of it getting bigger and brighter and whiter, it might look lovely and fluffy and nice and kind, but the chances are it's about to grow into a shower cloud and then maybe into a thunderstorm. So those are the ones you need to really watch out for. And they're called towering cumulus by the time. So there's 9 different types of cumulus. So number 1 cumulus is cumulus humulus. Cumulus humulus, so hard to say, is the tiny fluffy ones. And then cumulus type 9 is cumulonimbus, so the ones with the big anvil on top that give all the thunderstorms. So that's cumulus. There's also my favourite cloud is called a Kelvin Helmholtz wave.
Wow.
And it looks like a crest of a... Remember when you used to have to draw the letter C when you were in primary school? You go over the C, over the C, over the C. They literally look like crests of waves in the sky, and they're a sign of instability in the atmosphere because there's wind shear, different winds at different heights in the atmosphere, and they're pretty rare to see. I saw them once on a Weather Live on a Friday in Cornwall, actually, and it had been a really long week, and I actually cried when I saw them. Because one, because I was so tired and just really emotional, and two, I was just really excited to see something that I'd read about in real life. So they're pretty rare, they're very cool. There's also very funny clouds called outer cumulus mammatus, and mammatus is Latin for I can't think of another word, but mammary glands. So right. Some people call them booby clouds. So they look, they in the sky, they look like lumps coming down, some say boobs. Let's say that. And another one of my favorites is alto cumulus castellanus. So alto is middle layer, cumulus means it's fluffy, and castellanus means it looks like castle turrets. So you will literally see up, down, along, across, up, down, along, across, literally cumulus clouds that look like castle turrets in the sky. And they will grow and grow. And again, that's a sign of instability in medium levels. Usually the air will have come from Spain or maybe even Africa. And there's a sure sign that you will have some sort of shower or thunderstorm later in the day.
Goodness. Now, I'm intrigued because I think that people are becoming more obsessed with the weather because we are having to be outside during the pandemic. You know, all our possible social events that may well happen are based around being outside. Do you think that people are going to be more demanding of a precise weather? I mean, I know you give a precise weather, but because people could, can I get married on Saturday outside? You know, it's quite a lot of pressure, isn't it? It affects people's lives now that they're going to be outside.
It's huge. And particularly when people, you know, could only go out once a day for a really limited time, trying to plan. I had people often message me, when can I go out? Can I go out this time? Can I go out that time? I really want it to be dry. Our time outside is precious. And so, you know, I actually make sure that I've mentioned, like I did this morning, you know, the children have only just gone back to school and you're going to need your wet weather gear because it's going to be raining and it's going to be windy. So, you know, it's probably, never been more important than right now to know what the weather's doing, to be able to make the most of it. I was actually going to meet a friend for the first time in a year for a walk, and it's a bit too wet and windy, so we're not going now.
Yeah. And, you know, when it comes to pubs opening and people having to drink outside, gosh, it's going to impact everything, isn't it?
Oh, massively. I remember in the summer, I went with a friend to go for dinner. I wanted to eat outside, but the restaurant said, oh, you know, we're really worried about bad weather coming. So we're sitting everyone inside, and they could actually only book half the amount of people they wanted.
Yeah.
Because obviously everyone's sitting outside would want to come inside. So they just made half the bookings that day because you can't have everyone running inside.
No, your knowledge is becoming ever more important. Now, I can't end without mentioning poor Michael Fish from 1987, that storm. Oh, my goodness. That is why I have my fear of winds, because I remember that.
And wow, the great storm, 87,
I looked up on the Met Office. We were living in a house in a wood. I'll never forget opening the curtains in the morning and seeing all the trees.
Wow.
It's just unbelievable.
Devastating.
And I think something like, was it 15 million trees or something gone? So it's, I think I wanted to mention it because, not because of poor Michael, but it's the importance of continuing to plant trees, isn't it? We do lose them naturally.
Exactly. There's so many things that are really important there. I mean, I think that apparently Seven Oaks became One Oak. Some of the most beautiful old trees around got felled. And, you know, the more trees we have in the UK, it's better for so many reasons. It is better for protecting the ground beneath. It is better to help with drainage. It helps with flooding and there'll be less flooding. Obviously, they take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, which helps with trying to reduce the impacts of climate change. So yes, lawns are really important in our gardens. But if everybody could plant a tree, it would have benefits, you know, up and down the country and all around the world as well. But I have a funny, not funny, interesting thing to say about the Great Storm. So the Met Office supercomputer gathers weather information and data from satellites, from buoys, from ship orbs, from planes, from people all around the world. And it's pretty sophisticated. It looks at them, it does diagnostics. It looks at, you know, weighted, and a human observation would carry much more weighting than a ship observation or a buoy that's out to sea, because you can't guarantee that it's as accurate. And it depends, obviously, than the last time it was tested. So I'm sure this is true. I'm going to go with it. When the Great Storm happened, there was a ship, a buoy in the Atlantic to the southwest of the UK that recorded a very low pressure. And the computer didn't have anything else to verify with, so just said, that doesn't look right to me. I'm going to kick it out and I'm going to just carry on the forecast without it. They've since put this observation in and the storm was forecast almost exactly as it happened, just from this one observation. So the computers were sophisticated, but perhaps needed a bit more human intervention, which is great. Yay, we still have jobs.
Yeah.
I think it was after that that the National Severe Weather Service was born in the UK as well. So that's when, you know, the problem was that it was all spotted very late. The forecasts were put out very late. It was briefly mentioned in the 10 o'clock news. I think he mentioned that in the 6 o'clock news. People went to bed not knowing, not being prepared, not battening down the hatches. So, you know, we have much better forecasts, much longer range, and a much better warning service now.
Wonderful. Well, as a gardener, I appreciate your hard work and keeping us in the loop. And it's just been a joy for you to join me. Thank you so much. And I just think it's so relevant to us horticulturists. So we will all now be looking at the clouds and trying to suss out what the day's weather brings. So thank you, Laura.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure. And because of you, we've been getting out in the garden more, doing more gardening. I've actually just got an allotment as well. So
excellent. We're on our way. I want reports.
Okay.
Brilliant.
Well, I'm sure you'll agree that Laura has confirmed that gardening and weather certainly do go hand in hand. So it's no surprise that we talk about it every day. And I really do believe that we should continue to do so. Now, on April the 2nd at 6:45 for an hour, I'll be taking over the @Candide Twitter account, where I want to open up a conversation with you about the changing portfolio of plants that we are now growing to cope with our ever-changing climate. So until next time, keep an eye on the weather forecast and happy gardening.